This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, it's Sunday Fun Day. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm excited this Sunday morning. We've scored one of the big tunas, the big kahunas of Missoula. We have on our show today the luminary Tim Gordon.
I can't believe it.
And Tim Gordon, for our listeners, has been a longtime antique appraiser. He's a fine art consultant. He's worked with private museums and institutions and corporations and famous celebrities in terms of appraising their, you know, prized possessions. And most importantly for our listeners, he has been a regular guest for the past 12 years on Antiques Roadshow on PBS, which I'm addicted to. It's on in Missoula. It's on Monday night at 7 o'clock. Usually it's on PBS. It has almost the same size audience as Yellowstone does. They have almost 9 million here in the United States. An Antique Roadshow like The Voice or like, you know, America's Got Talent has been franchised all over the world. There's Antique Roadshows in the UK and lots of other countries, and he's been on there as one of the top appraisers in the country for many years. So I'm very excited personally to see to have Tim on the show and talk about some of the things that he's been involved in.
What do you think that taps into, by the way, that desire to look at people's like antique ephemera?
He started it when he was 11 years old, an interest in this sort of thing.
Oh my gosh.
And the people that watch it are addicted to it. To me, it's the combination between a learning experience, because you learn about all this stuff.
Right.
And it's like Price is Right. Almost everybody I know tries to guess what the thing's worth before they appraise it. You know, they go through this long lead-in, they talk all about it, and they say, do you have any idea what it's worth? And then they tell them. And right before then, everybody always wants to guess if it's like Price is Right, to see if you can if you can get it. And sometimes you're close and sometimes you're way off. But he has appraised, you know, Ronald Reagan's ranch. He's appraised Jim Morrison's estate, which is really kind of an interesting story. He's done the Yellowstone Park and Mount Rainier Park. He appraised Al Capone's family collection, which is an amazing kind of thing. Princess Di's jewelry and dress and, you know, collection and all that. Ed Sullivan, you know, for those of us who are older, Ed Sullivan's estate. He's done castles and ghost towns. And probably the most interesting one, which I know about from a few months ago when I ran into him, is that he is appraising the Steamboat Arabia.
What's that?
Which sunk in 1856 in 60 feet of mud. And the mud sort of hermetically sealed the entire steamship. And he was telling me, and we'll ask him more about this, that you could drink the water on there. Everything was preserved as if it was the day it went down in 1856. It had guns and, you know, money on it and clothing and food stuff. He said you could still to this day eat the food on there because it was so sealed. And he and a team of divers and other people went to explore all of this. So he's got a million interesting stories, you know, plus it'd be nice to know a little bit about the behind the scenes of Antiques Roadshow.
And most importantly, he is from here.
Here, graduated from University of Montana in 1988.
Can't wait. Tim Gordon is our guest. Back after this. Arnie Sherman, we are back with our guest,
Tim Gordon. I'm excited to have you here, Tim. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hey, thank you. It's kind of fun to be on a radio show in my own hometown.
So. You know, it's unusual to have such a luminary, you know, from Missoula. I mean, you're considered one of the top five appraisers in the United States. You can watch you almost every Monday night, even in reruns on Antiques Roadshow.
Ad nauseum.
Yeah. You know, it's one of my favorite. I was telling Scott before you came in, it's one of my favorite shows. It satisfies two sets of needs I have, and probably a lot of other listeners. One is to learn about all these different things. I mean, it's amazing stories, and the appraisers, you know, your colleagues on the show are great at, you know, giving all this history, and, you know, God knows how long it takes to put all that together. But it also gives this cross-section of, like, my urge to be on Price is Right, because I'm sure I'm not the only one, that before you say what it's worth, before you get to the point where – Did you ever have this appraised? What do you think? Everybody guesses what they think it's going to be before, you know, before you finally or the other appraisers finally say it. And I think that satisfies two sets of, you know, two sets of needs.
I think they have a wonderful formula, and it's been working for years. And I think the reason for that is that it's parallel to our working careers. Yeah, that happens day to day in my appraisal career. You walk into somebody's home and they have a treasure, and but they have all these preconceived notions. It's like, well, you know, the family has always said, and it's you know, when you take that oral history about value and provenance, it's always way off.
Yeah,
and it's like people talking, you know, where you see the whisper line, you whisper a line into somebody's ear, and by the time it goes five people, it's off. But
you know, President Washington has gave this to my great 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 grandfather, and you know, blah blah blah.
Who traditionally brings you into a new job? Is it the family? Is it a real estate agent? Is it all of the above?
You know, I run into people's lives at time of death, crisis, divorce, and need, and personal property and history. There's stories to be told, but they're also assets, and so. There's money, there's stocks, and there's stuff, personal property, and there's real estate. Well, I'm an expert in that, but you know, the good part of my career is it's fascinating. The more you scratch and the deeper you go on a historic object or an antique, they all have these stories that go back to their origin 100 years ago. A lot of times you can see those stories on their patina. You know, a lot of them have really weird, wild, old construction. They were hand hammered or hand forged by artisans. And so, yeah, wow. It's pretty fascinating.
Let me reel this back a little bit.
Yeah, please.
You Thank started you. Having an interest in antiquities and collectibles and that when you were 11 years old. So give me the background story, how you got to this point. You don't go to school to become an appraiser and, you know, this sort of thing. So how did you get to climb to the top of the hill of appraisers?
You know, I just was kind of a nut about it. I remember being 4 years old, and one of my older brothers gave me a 1780s coin. And so I'd sit and I'd hold that coin and look at it. Well, then another brother gave me it was a natural phenomenon. It was a piece of sandstone with a gem inside of it. And the water had dripped on it for a million years and created this gem inside of the stone. But later on, around you know the late 1960s, there was a national bottle craze, which brought everybody out to ranches and farms, and everybody was hitting the countryside looking for antiques. And you know, Montana had all these abandoned cabins sitting around, and ranches. You could talk to ranchers, and they go, "Oh yeah, just go out there in the barn, and you go out there, and there'd be saddles and trunks full of things," you know. But you know, that was many a year ago. And so that stuff, you know, it was probably 50 years old at the time, you know, so.
So that was the beginning, but then you went to University of Montana, right?
I did. I attended the University of Montana. I didn't get a degree though, because there is no degree in what I do. What I do, you have to read voraciously. I think that one component that I have that's really interesting is I was a dealer as well when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So I would go from antique show to back to buy things from little old ladies and, you know, out of their garages and ranchers and whoever had antiques, and then go sell it again. And I did that for about 15 or 20 years. And so after I had perfected that craft, then I started becoming an expert. A lot of people would call me and say, "Hey, Tim, what do I have?" And so at that point, that's when the appraisal started. You know, it's like, okay, you got to call Tim Gordon. He knows about Montana history, or he knows about cowboy objects or Native American artifacts at that time. And I started appraising, and I never looked back.
You know? And the more you appraise, you get a bigger audience of people that are aware of what your skills are, and you've gotten some amazing assignments over the years.
What was your first assignment? Like, how did they discuss somebody from, like, PBS? Was that your first mainstream media assignment?
Well, my first appraisal assignment that I'm super proud of was Virginia City, Montana, and Nevada City, Montana. So I was down in the town, and I was this expert I'm talking about. I was in my late 20s, and so the Bovey family, who owned a million artifacts down there, you know, the family had come from Pillsbury money, General Mills money. Charlie Bovey had come to Montana to learn the wheat business in the 1920s. gave up the wheat business and started collecting and filling up those ghost towns and restoring those ghost towns with antiques. Well, long story short, his son wanted to divest himself of both of the towns, and the state of Montana wanted to buy them as a state park. And so they sent into the, I believe, the Montana Historical Society and said, who's an expert in this sort of stuff? And they go, no, not this guy who's got businesses here, who's down the street. And so they hired me to appraise those towns.
How long did that take?
It took about 6 months to do the inventory, and there were a million individual pieces.
Oh my God.
What that means is, you know, a keg of nails is 1,000 things, but still it's probably the biggest personal collection west of the Mississippi.
And what was the final appraisal on a million things there?
Yeah, you know, that one I think is, you know, it was sold to the legislature for a certain price, and I think I was a component of that. And so at that time, you know, I'm going to, you know, because it's public record, I'm usually confidential. I'm going to say it's around $4 million for the artifacts.
Wow.
Yeah. It's going back a lot of years.
30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It was in 1998.
But so the when you did that, that was a big appraisal. Uh-huh. It's who found you and said, wait a minute, you should be doing this in more of a public forum.
Okay, so later on, I went into bigger projects. I did the contents of Yellowstone National Park for the federal government. I did the contents of Mount Rainier for the federal government. And then I started doing museums and state museums, and then university collections, and then art museum collections. And so what I would do is they wouldn't find me. I would reach out to people and show them my credentials, my CV. And then I would put in a proposal, and they go, well, heck, you know, our art museum has all these paintings and nothing's insured. Let's get this guy to do it. And so that's how I've climbed the ladder. As far as media, how I was brought into media, I was first brought in by WNET in New York as an expert on Frontier House. And so are you familiar with the program, you guys?
Yeah. And we're from back east, so we know WNET.
Yeah. So they were out here in Montana, and they wanted to do a show where they brought in modern people and had them homestead in Montana in the year 1883. And so here I am, this guy who's lived in the year 1883 all my life because I'm such a nerd. And so I was the one who was hired to help pick the clothing, pick all their articles they worked with. And then much to the sadness of the cast, I even helped pick their food. I did it through ledgers, 1883 food ledgers and general store ledgers.
So give me an example of what type of food in 1883.
A lot of what people were doing out here, you had venison, and then you had what you could raise. You know, there were seeds. But a lot of it was tinned. Like, you go to these ghost towns, and you find dozens of old tins that were tomato tins and oyster tins. But you know, it's
not preserved.
Yeah, peaches in cans. And so that's what the general stores in 1883 and their ledgers had. But then I had to even, like, nix their toilet paper and things.
Yeah, you were very popular at that point.
Yeah.
So, Tim, you're building this reputation. It's growing about the West, and you're an expert, and you're handling museums and towns and the shows. How did the Princess Di connection materialize out of that?
Yeah. Again, you know, there's it's like a Katamari ball. Are you familiar with the cat? Yeah. So the more I rolled through these appraisals, the more there weren't a lot of people doing that career professionally. It used to be a lot of the people that were in that career were auctioneers or dealers. Right. And so, you know, here it is, you know, around the year, you know, late 90s, year 2000, and I'm out there on the internet advertising as a professional appraiser. The Princess Diana collection of gowns, which was the main show for a couple of years at Kensington Palace. And so people would actually buy tickets to go in to see her gowns. Well, how that happened is there was a lady, so Diana, about 6 months before she passed away, she decided to clean her closet and get rid of all those gowns for a charity, and they had an auction at Christie's. And so She went into the auction and sat down, and another lady came in and sat down next to her and bought all the gowns. And so then they went on tour, and then a couple months later, 6 months later, Diana was tragically killed in the car wreck. You know? So that lady, she had them on display. She knew the value had changed from when she bought them at auction. And so she hired me to fly to London to appraise that. And so, all right, so you have this kid who comes from Missoula, Montana, who's going out through barns, and then later on he's appraising bigger projects. And then finally you get a call to fly to Kensington Palace as in a blue American suit, which they dug it because I was the American guy.
Right.
And they fit you up with a name badge, and they just kind of turn you loose in the palace to do your work. And it blew my mind, and it opened possibilities for me. It's like,
was that your first time in Europe?
No, there's a lot of things going parallel in my life. What I would do is I would go and work in Virginia City, Montana, or come back here to Missoula and earn money. And so two, 3 months out of the year, I would drop into Great Britain and do container loads. So I would drive all over the country and knock on doors and go to flea markets. And at that time, you could get incredible antiques in Europe. And then I would ship them back here and sell them at antique shows all winter. And so,
you were very, for a nerd, you were very industrious and had a very good marketing head to try to figure out how to do that. I mean, a lot of people would never even contemplate going over and looking at container loads of stuff in Europe. I mean, that would be mind-boggling.
What started that? Yeah, what was the impetus for that?
I'd always been a little bit of an Anglophile.
Sure.
And I think it had to do with a girlfriend got me over there the first time.
So let me ask you, I'm going to throw out some more of these things because I know about some of the stuff. Ronald Reagan's Ranch.
Yeah, yeah.
What year? Always start with what year this happened.
What is this?
Yeah. Ronald Reagan's Ranch started, it's ongoing. I was there last year, and I actually was there a couple of years before that.
Uh-huh.
So it's in the Santa Barbara area. And so Ronald and Nancy Reagan, that was their White House West. And so you drive the coastal road down to Vagabonds Bay or something with a name like that. And then all of a sudden you go, it's like you go straight up a mile and you're at Ronnie's ranch up there. And what really impressed me about it is, you go in and this was a real guy. He and Nancy were real people. Like, all right. So, he signed the big tax bill that he was famous for up in there. And then Queen Elizabeth and Philip went up, stayed there, and Gorbachev went up, stayed with him there. But what you're looking at, you guys, it would be like a little fishing shack on Sealy Lake, Montana,
right?
To where it's like a little cabin, and then there's porches built on it. And when you use the door to the bathroom, it hits the sink because the floors have all fallen, So that's what impressed me about that guy is
it was normal. It was like a normal place.
Yeah, the pillows on the bed were done by Nancy, and the kitchen table was his parents' Depression era round oak table, and then there's everything else is Western themed. You're just seeing him sitting in that chair,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but did you glean that same type of information when you did Diana's collection, like what the personality of this individual is like?
What happens is when I meet these people, you know them because it's your job to figure out why the things they left behind are of value, but it's more than that. There's a huge connection. And so there's a story that I've told it once or twice, but I know back to Diana's dresses. One day I had a black light out, a ultraviolet light, and I was looking for on the fabric to make sure that they weren't damaged in any way. And so these are works of art by the greatest artisans, the greatest dress designers, of the finest materials, of the finest princess of the last 500 years.
Totally.
And so you're holding them, and I was black lighting, and on the knee of one of her gowns, I saw all these grubby little fingerprints and I like jelly prints, and I think they're hairy or
oh wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. And you know, it's something where the objects, you know, you make a connection through the objects. I mean, that's pretty personal to be holding Diana's dress and looking at the ring around the collar and things. I mean, you know,
but it gets you the provenance in the sense of, you know, what was going on. You can almost feel that you're connected to it somehow.
Well, that's value.
Yeah.
If somebody had dry cleaned those, you know, let's say you take any famous person's anything and you spray it down with Armor All or dry cleaner or whatever, you ruin the value.
Did you ever encounter a family member who hired you to say, please don't touch that, and that, because that's very personal to me?
Yeah, I'm super respectful of that. You have to be, because it's all emotion. You know, there are people, I'll go in and I'll look at things with, you know, let's all kind of jack down a little bit here and know that I live here in Montana, and I also serve the people of Montana as pretty much the only, you know, guy doing what I do at the level I do. You know, there are other appraisers here and they're all fine and they're all capable, but so anyway, I just think that, you know, it's something that everybody's home, when they lose somebody, you have to have an appraiser come in and look at valuables if there are valuables there. Right. And that's your mother or father's piece. And I'm super, super respectful of
that.
I
have pieces that are personal because it was my dad's lighter that was given to him by his father or something like that. Yeah. Let me bring up another one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Jim Morrison's estate. Well, that was a crazy thing.
Oh, my God. That one...
Okay, take a black light to his clothes.
You know, sorry. Jim, what's cool about that? All right. So we'll just tell the story. I'll try to do it in 2 minutes here. Yeah. So I'm on TV and I run into Jim Morrison's college roommate. And so anyway, I do this interview with this great guy. He's an art teacher back east.
What's his name?
His name is Ed. Okay. And we'll stop there. Yeah. And so anyway, Ed's telling me all these great stories, how he's Jim Morrison's wingman, et cetera. Yeah, right. But anyway, I go home and the next day I get a call from Jim's family. And so what happened is Jim, he was having a little bit of trouble with the law down at Miami-Dade.
He got arrested.
Yeah. He got arrested on stage and they were saying that he had exposed himself or whatever, you know, Jim was, but anyway, what happened is he knew he was going to be in trouble and with that. And so he'd also had trouble with the band, because they had sold one of the songs without asking him, supposedly. I wasn't there.
Right.
So anyway, he just got out of Dodge. He went over to Paris. And that's where his girlfriend, Pamela Corson, was living.
It's where he's buried.
Yeah. And so she was eventually declared his common law wife. And so... So anyway, while he was in Paris, his head was in the space where he's writing poetry and lyrics, and I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of them in notebooks. And so, so the family called me, and they had just finally recently been given rights from Pamela's family to go in and to evaluate these writings. Well, what had happened is when Jim died in the bathtub in Paris, and all of his friends said it, you know, not to let, you know, get into history and conjecture here, said that he pretty much drank himself to death, that it wasn't heroin is what I've heard. But so anyway, she wanted to know, Pamela Corson wanted to know what to do with these writings. And so she talked to Michael McClure, who is a noted poet of the era. And he goes, I can't help you do anything with them right now. He goes, but you're living with people who aren't good. He goes, take them and lock them in a vault. And so later on, he was to write, sadly, that's what she did, because she overdosed about 18 months to 24 months later, I believe.
Yeah,
and so, 74. So anyway, this call after the show, when I'm talking to the college roommate, it was just a couple of days later, and they go, we'd like to have you come in and evaluate all that material that's never been evaluated.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking 2016.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the father was dead. Douglas.
He's way dead. The admiral. Yeah.
The admiral was dead. It was the sister that really was.
This was Anne and Andy, and I was contacted by Anne.
Wow.
So, so then I fly down and we, you know, it's a term. We crack open the vault.
Right.
And And so I photograph thousands and thousands of pages of these notebooks, not thousands, many hundreds. And then I had to push them into my brain and evaluate them so I could give a cohesive and a true value of their worth at that time.
How do you do that?
You know, so I'm doing personal property. I'm not doing the intellectual property.
Right.
And so there are auctions. Like if you look at a check by Jim Morrison at auction, it's like, you know, $8,000 to $16,000. Somebody, I think it was Graham Nash, ended up with one of these notebooks, and I think it went for $230,000. But I can't throw the actual values out, you know.
Right.
So you, what I'm saying is there are
benchmarks.
There are comps out there. Comparable values. Yep. Yeah.
That's cool. Let me bring up something else.
Okay.
We're bouncing around here.
Yeah.
Al Capone. How did you get involved with Al Capone?
Okay. So let's go to the year. This was last year.
Wow.
And so Al Capone. All right. So he had a rough life. He was a rough dude. And so
the only mafia guy ever put down by an accountant.
Yeah. Well, I think he was an independent.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But that's what they say, right?
Yeah.
What happened is I was contacted by his granddaughters, and when he passed away at his house in Miami Beach, Florida, that would have been right after he got out of San Quentin. Alcatraz, and I think he got out in 1947, right before he died. So what happened is the family they had all that stuff, and they were living with it. And so I was called in to go through their houses and just tell them, it's like, well, don't you understand? That's Al Capone's chair, you know? or that's Al Capone's pistol.
Right,
you know,
that's even more.
And so this was, you know, I don't want to tell too much of their personal story, but they are lovely, lovely, sweet women. And so what happened is the minute that anybody in any town ever heard that they were a Capone, like one of the gals told me that her first day of school was hell. You know, so they ended up changing their names, you know, and living in different areas and things. But this wasn't like, you know, anyway, they hired me to come in and put a value to it, and then it sold at auction.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Is there a commonality in terms of the reason why people contact you? Is there insurance? They need the money, or it's financial, or it's for posterity. Like, what are the chief reasons why a Capone family or a Morrison family would hire you?
Yeah, legacy for the Morrisons, legacy for the Capones. I also, you know, I protect things, you know, by having a value on it, then you can insure it.
Sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If it's lost. Like right now I'm working on a project, and this is probably one of my favorite projects. It's down in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's the Steamboat Arabia. And in 1856, this thing was going up the river, and it hit a snag, and it sank within a minute. And the water was so deep and so cold, and it went so far into the silt that 250 tons of 1856 cultural material stuck in that mud down there. And nobody died. There was one mule.
How far down?
Yeah, I don't know how deep it was. I'm going to say, you know, 150 feet maybe.
Got it. And was this steamboat on its way to heading west? Was it one of these cargo or supply steamboats?
It was. It was filled with anything that you would need on the frontier. And so there's barrels of trade beads. There's jars of pickles. Well, anyway, before we get into that.
Right.
It all perfectly preserved. And so,
because it was like hermetically sealed by the mud or whatever?
Yeah, and then the river changed course, and so it was found in a cornfield, and it was brought up by a couple of guys whose family were doing it as a hobby. So now it's a major museum in Kansas City. But what I love about that project is 250 tons of material goods. There's shirts that are like military societies right before the Civil War.
Right.
There's food. You can actually, one of the workers ate one of the pickles, you know.
And didn't die.
It's an old pickle. Yeah. There's bottles of cognac. There's guns. There's all this stuff. And they've been restoring it and it's a museum in Kansas City, but now they've found another one, the Malta, and that's from 1851.
Wow.
But what's cool about this is everything that I see there as a historian in books, in TV, in art, you don't see these varieties. So it was like, you know, I crawled through that window, and I was in 1856. I time traveled, and it'd be like going to the bottom of the ocean and saying, what kind of fish is that?
You know, right.
It's like, that's some weird.
Are you filming and photographing all the way through to keep a record of this?
You know, I last year, I think I shot like 30,000 photos of things.
Wow.
You know, so that's kind of part of my job, is to record condition. And then, you know, I'm always in production for some new TV show. It's like, you got such a fascinating life. Let's do a TV show on you.
Let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Tim Gordon, appraiser, world renowned appraiser and preserver of legacy.
Yes.
For many, many people. Arnie.
So as I remember from my history, a lot of those steamboats from Kansas City were coming out to Fort Benton. That's where a lot of them would end up. So it was really had a sort of a Montana connection. This was, you know, trade items to come out to the West to, you know, to in return for fur and trappers and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And so these guys were Dave Howley is the guy who restored it and brought it up. So he has drilled. He's found other steamboat wrecks. And if he runs an auger down and it comes up with fur, he doesn't dig it up.
Right.
And so the most recent one, the Malta that he's run into, he ran an auger down and he showed this artifact to me. When it came back up out of the earth, it had a blanket bandolier bag made out of blanket. And he opened it up, and it had 100 brass buttons in it to trade to the Native Americans out here. And it was heading kind of sort of this way.
Do you ever get this? Do you ever like say, "I wish so and so were here. I wish so and so was there." When you're actually doing all this, yeah. Take a drink of water. You've been talking. But do you know what I mean, Arnie?
Yeah.
It's like I'd be like, I wish my best friend were here to see this, or I wish my wife was here to see this.
Well, if you're if you're in the music industry, as you've been, seeing Jim Morrison's poems and lyrics and stuff would be astounding. It'd be like finding, you know, a trove of Beatles, you know, stuff that had never been.
Well, you're myth
before.
Busting. You're a myth buster, because they may have thought he was doing the following. Everyone was speculating what he does. You have the evidence. You have the
like yesterday.
The record.
Yeah, thank you. Well, yesterday, for instance, you wouldn't believe that things exist from people. So for a client of mine, he's collected all his life. He's a pretty wealthy guy down in Atlanta. Yesterday, I appraised his things, and then he was able to take them to auction yesterday, and they sold the pirate Jean Lafitte sword yesterday.
Wow.
They sold Davy Crockett's Bowie knife yesterday.
Wow.
These are amazing things. They sold what they think is Andrew Jackson's rifle, which was all engraved old hickory on it. And so what's neat is, okay, sometimes I'll discover it and the information will come out through me as a megaphone, what I've found. But sometimes you run into things and you just don't believe that they possibly could exist.
I mean, Davy Crockett's knife. It's crazy. I mean, you know, as a kid, you watched the show and he had the knife. And there's only one of them, right? I mean,
there's one knife. I have a question because we've been spending a lot of time looking back.
Yeah.
What advice would you give people who have a lot of stuff?
Yeah.
Looking forward, what should they do so that your work is a lot easier when you have to do an appraisal?
Sure.
But also cataloging, right? If it's like a musician or an artist or a writer, what advice would you give?
You know, the documentation is what's always missing. So it's like a lot of times I show up and it's an estate. And so there, I have to resurrect the stories of things. And so let's say, like, for instance, recently I was contacted. I know you like rock and roll. Contacted to assist with marketing Jimi Hendrix's Fender guitar that he gave to Frank Zappa. And so,
I saw something on that.
Yeah. So anyway, it never really touched my hands.
Working with Jimi Hendrix?
It never really touched my hands. But what happened is I advised on that. And so let's say that guitar just ended up in a garage somewhere. You know, so how do you know it's Jimi Hendrix's guitar? You can't. So you people who have important things need to document them. Right. And maybe even go so far as to keep that documentation, excuse me, with the artifact.
Right, because they could easily get separated, sure, over time.
When you do a Jim Morrison thing, uh-huh. are there groups of people that are like fans / archivists themselves who are like, what have you found? Like, are you able to disseminate that information to like that core nucleus of people, if the family lets you, I guess?
That one. Okay. So how that all shook out is nobody had ever seen this material. And so it's sitting in a vault and the family contacts me to go in and evaluate it. And so for 2 years, I'm the only guy walking around with all these songs and this poetry in my head. And it really affected me.
Were you a fan
me.
Before?
Oh, yeah. I'd been
to his... So this was an exciting project.
Yeah, I'd been to his grave at Pierre Lachaise when I was 20.
I've been there.
Yeah.
And they're still putting flowers on it.
Yeah.
To this day.
They're graffiti.
The old one had a bust of him on top.
Yes, yeah. that was that one.
Yeah, and so...
Well, I think it was. I don't know. When did it move over to the new cemetery, Pierre Lachaise? Or new... What happened? Because I was there in the early 90s.
I think they just changed the tombstone because it was defaced so much. Yeah,
they didn't move them. They just changed
it. But ask your question again. You lost it.
My question was, once all these people find that you have access to all this, let's say for the Doors...
Yeah. I can't talk about it until I'm given permission. I'm always confidential. But what's cool about this is Jim's legacy, that's what the family wanted more than anything, was to get it out into the public and for the future. And so in January of this year in London, all of that was published. And so you're going to start seeing Jim Morrison poetry and songs just like cropping up like flowers.
People are going to start recording it, right? Or get permission for
recording. They have to license it, right? Because the family owns it.
We won't get into all that.
But eventually you're going to start hearing his words again.
There's a management group who handles all that.
What's interesting about what you're saying is that there's a whole other industry now that can crop up from the work that you did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a huge amount of licensing opportunities.
Before we talk about Antique Roadshow, because I want to talk a little bit about that. Let me ask you this. You're a Missoula guy. Let's bring it back home here. Yeah. What's the most interesting, astounding, unusual thing that you've come across, you know, here in Missoula, here in Montana, in your work?
Okay. So when I was about 16, I went to a little house over by Sacagawea Park. And I'm sure the people that live there now know nothing about this, but... But there was a really interesting lady who lived here in Missoula, and her uncle had been Captain Donald McIntosh with Custer. He'd been killed with Custer. Another uncle had won the Nobel Prize. And then over her mantle, over the fireplace, was one of John Brown's pikes that he hand-hammered for his attack, you know?
Wow.
And so... So it's like, you know, it's a little salt box looking house, you know, and so it's like triple whammy one morning when I'm a younger guy looking for treasures. And so,
that's really cool.
What type of technology do you use? You must have been doing this for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's lots of great stuff. You know, I'm actually, you know, on my iPhone when I'm in houses continuously. It's like, on the way over here, I got a call from a friend, and so it's an estate coming up, and he goes, "Do you know about a kind of stamp?" Well, I don't know everything. I know dang near everything because, you know, I have a photographic memory, and I've been doing this a lot of years. But so I just real quick flipped out my phone, and bang, I was able to tell him about it and actually tell him values. But you need more than that. That gets you onto the target, and then you have to figure out, well, which variant of this stamp is, what's the condition, what's the background, what's it on, you know.
Can you recall in your memory, like, your network of experts in certain area, like a stamp expert or a vinyl LP expert or a, you know.
Sports memorabilia.
What's nice about, you know, having been on that show you talked about.
Right.
You know the principles right. in every auction house and every expert that there is. Yeah.
Well, as I read about Antiques Roadshow, I mean, there are about, on the average show, there's maybe 70 appraisers that are brought together to work on a show. The show, for those who don't watch it, has almost as big an audience as Yellowstone every week, if you can believe. I mean, there's 8, 9, 10 million people are watching Antiques Roadshow on a weekly basis. So tell me, how did you get brought into the family there?
Yeah, so, you know, I always say that, you know, I've appeared as an expert on Antiques Roadshow, and I've done it as a collectibles appraiser and an ethnographic appraiser, et cetera. So I don't want to tell too many of their trade secrets.
No, no,
however, you're invited. It's a lifetime, you know, it's an honor to be invited because sure. It's through your peers.
Oh, that's how you get selected.
Yeah, and so I've got some great peers, and you know what's nice is it's, you know, I think programs like that are Broadway for what you do. Yeah.
How do you keep it at the PBS level and don't get brought into, let's say, the schmaltzy level of like what is that porn stars or stuff like
porn stars?
By the way, us from back east have a hard time saying pawn and porn. Yeah. It's the same word, Doug.
That's my accent.
How did you find out about my profile?
Yeah, right.
Have you ever, I'm sure. What have you found in those art?
Ask me the question again.
How did you stay in the PBS lane, not get into the, like the kind of pawn star lane of like Bravo TV mess?
Yeah. So I've actually worked on two projects about myself, and you know, it eventually comes down to that question. It's like, hey, this is way too cool to just like ham it up, you know that. What I see is the humanity in this business and the poignancy and the crazy stories and it is a lot like Seinfeld. It's kind of a show about nothing, you know. And so it's like there's laugh your ass off humor in this business, but you don't need to make it corny or formulaic, and that's what a lot of the networks want, I think.
Sure. Yeah. I mean one of the things about Antiques Roadshow is that you have those moments, but you also have very poignant moments where people are talking about their family, their history, or they have something that is valuable and, you know, you can attribute it to what they thought it was. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people who get tears in their eyes before they hear what it's worth or not worth, you know. And they're all American, you know, at least on that version of it, because it's all over the world. I mean, there's a British version. There's many versions of Antique World. It's a very American story, you know, even though, and it's an immigrant story. A lot of the things that are there are Americans showing gifts that come from all over the world.
We're also nosy people. We're also voyeuristic.
Yeah.
So what is the most absurd thing you found without breaching confidence? And what is the most poignant, sweetest thing that you found?
Yeah.
Start with absurd.
Absurd. So in my career, I've had crazy things come my way. You know, it's like one time somebody approached me and they had a nun's beatified finger. And then
oh, that's what I thought you would say.
And then you'll have somebody who will just happen to have a freeze-dried shih tzu. I mean, no disrespect to animals. I love animals. I think that's brutal. But anyway, I'm sorry.
What's,
you know?
What's this worth? My frozen dog.
Oh, man.
So you bronze your turd.
Yeah, right.
And I have had coprolites, which are dinosaur poop. Yeah. So.
Have you ever... never mind. What's the most poignant, sweetest thing you found?
Oh my God, that's a day-to-day vocation. You know, one thing I'll do is sometimes I'll do an estate. You know, a lot of what I do is for the Montana people, and I try to help Montanans out, and that includes a lot of estate work. And so there was a lady who'd been a school teacher and had died in her 90s and had no heirs, and the minute you walk into that house with a key and you sell her things and there's no heirs, poof, she doesn't exist anymore. And so, so not to get all metaphysical and weird on you, but what I did is I grabbed a box. I grabbed, you know, that had her photographs in it. I grabbed something I knew that meant really a lot to her. And then I grabbed some letters that actually tied up, you know, you talked about Missoula, to the artist, Edgar S. Paxson, our master Western painter. And then I sealed them in a box, so it's a life in a box. And I have about 10 of those. It sounds weird, but as long as that stuff is in that box, that
person
still exists.
Yeah, that's really
How's
cool.
How's that for a show for you?
That's a very good show.
In a box.
So you talk about show. what does the future look like for you? I mean, what are you working on? Because you got, you know, your curiosity and your interest is ever expanding. You know, you don't haven't lost any enthusiasm from when you were 11 years old for doing this sort of thing, and you're getting, you know, even, you know, more expansive in the kind of work you do. Mm-hmm. So what's down the road for Tim Gordon?
Yeah, we have some big museum collections. So what that looks like is we'll get hired by, say, an art museum, and we'll walk in the front door, and a week later we'll walk out the back door, and we'll have inspected every painting in there. And so the one I worked on this year is the Charles M. Russell Art Museum. What an honor that was
you know, to do
Charlie Russell's things. Holy moly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm still working on the steamboat inventory. I get crazy calls. A lot of times I'll get a call, and there's a lady called me last night at about 9 o'clock, and she's in Lafayette, Georgia, and she has quite a large collection, and I think I might be on an airplane heading that way.
Yeah. You
know? So a lot of it is impulse.
Are there any jobs that you've turned down for political nature or
whatever reason?
No, history is salient. And so you don't have – okay, let's talk about political nature. It's history. And so there are things that are creepy that I just don't want to mess with, you know.
I have my Nazi collection
I'm not a big fan of that sort of stuff. No.
I would – good to hear. So I think I mentioned to you that I'm involved with the Lou Reed Archive.
Cool.
That has been donated to the New York Public Library. But I'm curious to know your thoughts about an archive like a Lou Reed Archive or the Bob Dylan – archive that's now in it's in Nebraska, it's in Tulsa, I believe.
I think it is.
Yeah, they just did that. And could you be brought into an archive to appraise the archive?
Yeah, I do that all the time. Let's see. So a personal archive like that, sure, certainly. That's what I do.
Even if it's out in the public, so the public can access it now.
Yeah. Yeah, because what you're doing is you're assigning value for insurance purposes.
Got it.
Yeah, so it's replacement value is what I would be hired for. And so, yeah, like the state of Nevada, I was hired to appraise their treasures. And one of their treasures was Howard Hughes was doing a movie in the desert in the 1940s. And being Howard Hughes, when he left, he just sealed the house up. And so there's his grape nuts in there and his toilet paper and his steno pads and his pencils. And yet it's Howard Hughes. And he was Elon Musk before Elon Musk.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And so it's like, you know, I'll go in and, if I find it fascinating, I'll go in and do it. Let's go back to the other topic, though. I stay away from things that offend people. And you know, no, I don't go there.
Let's take a quick break, Arnie. Our guest is Tim Gordon, appraiser, world-renowned appraiser and preserver of legacies. Back after this. Arnie, we are back with Tim Gordon.
So I saved one area for the very end for us older people. I really like the really big shoe that Ed Sullivan had. You did Ed Sullivan. He must have had amazing stuff from all the guests that he had over the years.
Yeah, what an incredible personality. I mean, wow, an impresario. But, you know, that guy, what was cool about him is in the late 20s, he was doing sports. And so he started a lot of careers. He had a little office in New York City, and people would drop in and they go, Ed, help me with my career. And all of a sudden, you know, you'd see all these movie stars spring out of that association. Let's see. I'm usually really, really super confidential about certain things.
Sure. Right. But yeah, he had every big star of the generation was on the Ed Sullivan Show. That was the mecca at one point, even the Beatles. So let me ask you this. We're running out of time, and I wish we had hours more. We're going to bring you back. How do people get a hold of you if they have an assignment and they want to reach out to Timothy Gordon? How do they find you?
Yeah, I'm usually hanging out on a bar stool down at the press box down here. No, I have a really good website. Just Google me. You'll find me.
Good.
So Google Timothy Gordon. We have 1 minute left already. I don't want to lose a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is there someone in the world of appraisal that you admire that was your mentor or somebody that really helped you see the opportunity before you did? Or
you know, it was usually old time collectors who were at these shows who were sweet people, and there's a confraternity of collectors. And So I was mentored probably by just people I would see at antique shows and people I knew in the business who were sweethearts, you know.
Right, and they would take their time and they would tell you their stories and give you advice and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, as far as one expert who I think is the guru, I don't know that guy.
Well, we might have him here in the studio right now.
No.
No, yes, we do.
But I feel like, yeah, really, all roads come back to Tim Gordon.
Yeah. That's the way we like it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Missoula.
Yep.
Anyway, Tim, thank you so much.
You're welcome. What fun. It was a great talk. Thanks, guys.
We'll do it again.
Yep. All right, Arn, I'll see you next Sunday.
Next Sunday, Scott. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.